I lived in Manchester for 5 years while I was at university and trained to be a teacher. And I lived in a few different houses and places while I was there, but all in the same area, which was an area called Rusholme. And it's known for a street where they call it the Curry Mile. And so it's actually half a mile, but it's got curry houses and takeaways on both sides. So they class it as a mile. It probably sounds a bit easier to say Curry Mile and Curry Half Mile. But there's loads of curry houses there, so you end up going out for a lot of curries. I like curry, but I don't eat a lot of them. And certainly, there was people who I knew would go for them like 2 or 3 times a week. I wasn't anywhere near that, but I went for a decent amount of curries during my time there. And over time, we sort of established we used to refer to them as rules for like making a decision of where to go. So if somebody asked you where should we go, there was a number of questions you had to establish the context. So who are you going with? Because if it's your parents are in town for the weekend and they're taking you for a curry, then you should always go to Shia Khan because that's more expensive. So you wouldn't go to it unless they were paying, but it's nicer. Were you looking for somewhere where you wanted to take your own drinks? Because that is a thing that students want to do. And a number of them were unlicensed sort of premises. So if you're looking for somewhere, then that might influence where you're going. Were you looking for larger portions, or were you looking for quality? And there was different things like that. Now, when I was in my, I can't remember, it was third year or possibly fourth year. At some point when I'd been there a few years, my brother started as a first year in Manchester. And on his course, he was doing computer science. They were in little groups or whatever, put in your tutorial group. Oh, let's get to know each other. We'll go out for a curry. Where should we go? Don't really know anywhere. And Peter had picked up these rules off me because he'd visited me a few times. And so he'd be like, oh, well, are we doing this? Are we looking for this? And he sort of became the fountain of knowledge for he remembers a 2 month period before people found out their own information, where people he didn't know would come up to him and say, oh, are you the person who knows all about the Curry Mile and where should go? And he loved being that. Now, the reason why I say that is the number one rule, first on the list was, where should we go for a curry? Number one, you don't go to the Royal Naz, right? That was the first rule. And then you work your way down from there. And if anybody's that interested, I can tell you why you don't go to the Royal Naz later, but it's not massive interest. But the point was, it was watch out for the Royal Naz. Beware the Royal Naz. Don't go there. And the problem was, that was if you came down from the university, that was a prominent one, one of the first ones you got to. So you had to warn people off that. Now, I'm coming on to warnings. That's why I mentioned that. Now, there might be things like that where you would warn somebody, you know something about something, and you say, oh, watch out for that. Beware that. Don't give that a wide berth. Is there a person that you might warn somebody about? Would you ever say, oh, beware, watch out for that person, and give her a wide berth? I was thinking in a workplace, if somebody's starting new, there's sometimes oh, just watch out for that person. Certainly in my workplace, there's somebody who I might warn people about, although actually I end up not warning people about it because I don't want to sort of give them a preconceived idea. And then as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, actually, at my workplace, I think I am also one of the people who people warn them about, don't associate with him, you'll get your name in the blacklist or something. So there might be things like that where you're warning people, oh, beware of him, watch out for him or her. Now, that's what Jesus does here. He says, beware of these people. He's warning his disciples and anybody else who's listening about being or watch out for these people. Now, Jesus has done this quite a lot in Luke's gospel. In fact, we did a little series on risks to your faith where Jesus tells people to watch out for certain things. It was around about Luke 12, and it was about 2 years ago we were looking at that. And there was a number of things where Jesus was saying, watch out for this, beware of this. So hypocrisy was one of them. Watch out, beware the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And then another one was fear of man, watch out for this fear of man. Another one was complacency about Jesus returning. It's watch out for that. Be on your guard against that. And here, Jesus does a similar thing. He tells his followers to beware of something. Now, just let's remember where we're at here. Jesus has come into Jerusalem at sort of the height of his popularity, with people lying in the streets and shouting and waving palm branches. And then he comes in and he spends a bit of time sort of teaching in Jerusalem. And it's this sort of powder keg of a surge of popularity and a surge of sort of negative, whatever the opposite of popularity is, negative feeling. He came in, he drove the traders out of the temple, and then he's been teaching, and Some people have questioned his authority, and he's sort of knocked that one back. And then Jesus has told a parable that's clearly criticizing the religious leaders, and they're not happy about it. Then they try and trap him with a question about a political question about Caesar, and he comes up with a brilliant answer to that. And then they come up with a theological question to try and fox him, and he comes up with a brilliant answer about that. And then he asks a question about the Messiah and what they know about the prophecies about the Messiah, and they can't answer it. And you get all these things that the religious leaders were looking for ways to kill him, but they didn't dare do anything because they were afraid of the people. And then they're asking him things to try and catch him out, and his answers are so good that it ends up with the saying, nobody dares to ask him any more questions. And so it's in that context, a sort of swell of popularity, but also a swell of negative feeling against him, that Jesus now stops talking to the religious leaders and talks to his disciples. He turns to his disciples, but with all the people still listening. So if you look at verse 45, while all the people were listening, Jesus said to his disciples. So this thing that he's saying, because he's just been talking to the religious leaders just previously, he's turned away from them, he's talking to the disciples, but it isn't like he's gone off with his disciples. Everybody's still able to hear this. And what he says to them is, verse 46, beware of the teachers of the law. Right? So it's a warning. Like, watch out for these people. Now, those people are probably still there. Or even if they've gone off, like, it's not just like he's gone away and he said, oh, remember those people we talked about. He's saying it in front of the crowds, beware the teachers of the law. And then Jesus talks a bit about what these teachers of the law are like and why we need to beware of them. Let's just read from verse 46. Beware of the teachers of the law. They like to walk around in flowing robes and love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at the banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. These men will be punished most severely. I forgot to mention we were in Luke chapter 20, but that's where we are, page 1056. I'm going to keep going just at the start of chapter 21. As Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. He also saw a poor widow putting two very, very small copper coins. Truly, I tell you, he said, this poor widow has put in more than all the others. All these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on. So Jesus is warning his disciples, and the other people listening will hear this, he's warning them about the teachers of the law. First of all, he says, they like to walk around in flowing robes. Like, they obviously look good. If they're walking around with these flowing robes, people notice them, they're impressive. People see that they look good. It says that love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces. Now, if you've got experience with the Bible, we're used to seeing these people as like the baddies, the villains. But that's not how they would have been thought of at the time. These were the people who you respected. And as they were walking through the marketplaces, people would be greeting them with respect. They were respectable and people respected them. It says they have the most important seats in the synagogue. But these people were like really serious about following God. They devoted their lives to the synagogue and the temple and to the scriptures. The reason why they had the most important seats in the synagogues was because they were the most knowledgeable. They knew the most about God's law and the temple and the synagogue, what it meant to be a Jewish person. They were the ones with the most experience. They were the leaders. That's why they had the most important seats. People were looking up to them. And Jesus says they love to have the places of honour at banquets. You know, if you were having a banquet, like these were the people you wanted to invite. Oh, invite them. And it was like, let's get them to this banquet. These would have been the important guests. If they had them coming to your banquet, you would like make an extra effort. You would get like the good china out and that sort of thing. They make lengthy prayers, he says. Now, Jesus is criticizing this, but just put yourself in the mindset of other people who are just hearing these lengthy prayers. You think, there's somebody who really knows like what they're talking about with God. You know, this person's really serious. They listen to those prayers, so inspiring. Now, the start of chapter 21 doesn't mention the religious leaders explicitly. It's talking about like you see these rich people putting gifts into the temple. That might be the same people, it might not. But even if it's not, it's still talking about things that look impressive. So these people, these religious leaders, flowing robes, places of honor, important seats, greeting with respect, they looked impressive. And these rich people putting their gifts in, that also looked impressive. They were coming into the temple and there was these large like containers where people would give these gifts. And these rich people are putting loads in. It's impressive. Impressive stuff from impressive people. Now, they were really serious and well worth respecting. They were giving their money for God's kingdom. As I said, we used to see these people as baddies, but they, at the time, were impressive people, respected people. They looked good. So what's the problem then? Because we know the story. We've just read it. Jesus is not commending these things. He's telling his disciples to beware of them. Well, Jesus points out what the issue is. The issue is that they love it. They love those things. They like to walk around in flowing robes. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplace. They love that respect and honour. They love that status. They want the most important seat. They're motivated by their reputation amongst others. We've seen that. In that really, they want to get rid of Jesus, but they daren't do it because he's so popular. They don't want to go against the public feeling. They don't care about people. In verse 47, it says, they devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. The contrast there is, how can those two things go together? The devouring widows' houses bit isn't exactly clear what he means. It seems to be criticised that they would take advantage, rather than looking after the most vulnerable in society, they would take advantage of them. Jesus criticises similar things elsewhere. The people who had a financial duty to look after their parents would say, oh, well, I'm giving that money to God, and leave their parents unattended for. It's that they don't care about people. Well, we'll make these lengthy prayers to God. That's the sort of thing that, as you read the prophets in the Old Testament, that God speaks about over and over again. And you're neglecting the widow and the orphan, but you're coming into the temple and offering these sacrifices, and God tells him to shut the doors. He doesn't want to hear that. Now, at the start of chapter 21, where Jesus is pointing out this poor widow putting in two very small coins, it's not totally clear what Jesus is pointing this out for. It might be that it's a comment on generosity, talking about the widow's generosity, although Jesus doesn't actually say that. Some people say that this is a comment on the corrupt religious system at the time. And so Jesus said, oh, they devour widows' houses. For example, look at this woman, where the religious system is demanding that she puts in her last two copper coins. Either way, the point is, the religious leaders there don't care about these people. They don't care about the likes of this woman. They love to be greeted with respect. They love the most important seats. They'll make these, for a show, lengthy prayers. That's what Jesus says. He doesn't say they make lengthy prayers. They do it for a show. While meanwhile, they don't care about the most vulnerable. They don't care about people, but they care about what people think about them. It's textbook hypocrisy. Now, that sort of hypocrisy isn't always obvious from the outward actions. So the average person seeing these religious leaders wouldn't necessarily think, oh, they're doing all that for show. But the difference is, Jesus sees the heart. Jesus sees the motivation behind it. He can see the heart, he can see the motivation, and that's what he warns the disciples about. I think that's why Jesus points out the widow. Jesus notices the outwardly unimpressive. He notices the people that nobody else notices. The coins there that she gave, were like the lowest denomination of currency that was around at Jesus' time. It's like somebody putting 2 pence in today. It's totally unimpressive from the outside. Probably nobody even noticed that she was there, but Jesus did, because he sees the heart, not the outward appearance. You know, there could be crowds of up to 15,000 in these outer courts of the temple, and there's people in flowing robes coming with massive gifts putting them in. And there's a little old woman like shuffling around putting these 2 coins in. She's pretty much invisible amongst all the impressive people. But it's like Jesus was looking with different glasses on. And all those people faded into insignificance when God sees this woman's heart of generosity. Now, later this year, we're going to be doing a series in the book of Samuel, and I just was thinking about one of the stories in there in relation to this. And one of the things that God gets Samuel to do is to anoint a king, right, a king for Israel. And they get a king, which is Saul, and Saul's described as like handsome, good-looking, and head and shoulders above everybody else in Israel. Like, he looked like a king. He was an impressive character. But different things happen that we'll look at when we look at 1 Samuel, and God rejects him after a while. And God says to Samuel, I want you to go and anoint a new king. I'm going to show you who it is. And God directs him to the family of Jesse, and Jesse sort of parades his seven sons in front of Samuel. And when Samuel sees the first one, he says to himself, oh, surely this must be the Lord's anointed. And we don't know what it is, but it must have been that Eliab, the first son, looked impressive in some way. And God says this to Samuel. Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Man looks on the outward appearance, the Lord looks on the heart. Now, God had actually chosen Jesse's eighth son, who Jesse hadn't even bothered bringing in. That was David. He's so young, so insignificant, that Jesse hadn't even thought it was worth bringing him in. But God doesn't look at what looks significant and what looks impressive. He looks as the heart, looks on the heart. That's what's going on here. Jesus is saying, beware of these people. And these are the impressive people. But God doesn't see as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance. God looks at the heart. The teachers of the law looked impressive, but Jesus saw that their hearts were black. The widow looked unimpressive, but Jesus saw a generous heart that nobody else would have noticed. So that's what Jesus is talking about. Let's just think about that warning then, because Jesus is clearly giving a warning. He says, starts with by saying, beware. And so Jesus thought his disciples needed to watch out for that. This was worth warning them about, that this was a risk for them. The same for the crowds of people who were listening. It's the same for us. We need to beware of this danger. Verse 47, after talking about devouring the widow's houses and for a show making lengthy prayers, Jesus said, these men will be punished most severely. Remember, all the people are listening to this. This is a massively controversial thing to say. All these people, these impressive, respectable religious leaders, you need to watch out for them. It says a little bit about them. They're going to be punished most severely. This needs to be a warning to us as well, because I think a lot of the time, if you're like me, we spend a lot of our time trying to polish our outward appearance. Let's just think through some of the things that Jesus points out about the teachers of the law and how they might apply to us. And the first were like the flowing robes, the appearance. I was just thinking about this for myself, and I remember when I arrived at university that what I was wearing a West Hartlepool rugby shirt, and I was wearing, because this is cheesy, but because me and Lisa were going to be spending like the year apart, she bought one of those things, you know, it's a coin that's split in two, so I was wearing half of that on a chain around my neck with this West Hartlepool rugby shirt on. I looked so cool. It's a wonder why I struggled to make friends when I arrived there. Anyway, I wasn't thinking that morning, right, I'm going to wear this in order to project a certain thing. But looking back, like, there was something obviously going on there that I was trying to project something. I was trying to show something about myself by the clothes that I was wearing. We want people to think a certain way about us by the way we look. Now, for some people, that's they want to look impressive, and they want people to think, oh, they wear such nice clothes. For other people, it's communicating, oh, that person's not bothered about materialistic things like that. They never go in for stuff like that. But either way, we can all be affected by this. I remember talking to some friends of ours who lived in America who went to a Christian university there. So people who went there were sort of all professing to be Christian. And they said that there was like quite a number of people, because the culture was everybody was supposed to be Christian and everybody would be going to church on a Sunday. That some people who'd been out like sort of living a wild lifestyle on the Saturday night and had slept in and hadn't made it to church on the Sunday morning wouldn't want to be seen like rolling out of bed at lunchtime. So they'd get up and sort of dress in like smart clothing, pick their Bible up, and then like sort of walk into the canteen for their lunch as if they'd arrived from church. because the culture there was, oh, everybody's just come for their lunch after church, and they wanted to show by their appearance, so dress up and get my Bible and go in there. Now, that's not the sort of culture that we're in there, but what is it for us that we hope and the people notice about us? What is it about the way we present ourselves that we are hoping to project this certain image? What about the attention? The teachers of the law loved to be greeted with respect. And again, I've just been trying to think about these things, how they relate to me. And obviously, because I've started thinking about things that were like 20 years ago, like those things were on my mind. And I remember once, when I was at college, about 17, 18, there was a series of, like, everybody was having an 18th birthday party, and just everybody would sort of go to it. So we were always at an 18th birthday party. And I remember arriving at one, can't remember whose it was, and I was arriving, and I had one of my friends was coming with me who didn't know that many people there. And anyway, it was just, as I arrived, like, I saw somebody outside who knew, like, oh, Michael, said hello, shut the door. As we went in, saw somebody on the stairs who knew, saw somebody coming out the toilet, saw somebody, and just as we went in, my friend was like, oh, you know everybody here. It was like that scene from Goodfellas where he's going through, or at least in my mind, it was like that scene. It was a lot less cool than that scene. But the problem was, I remember that now. It's like, oh, it felt so good because it seemed, oh, I knew everybody. And he's like, oh, you know everybody. And it just, I felt like, oh, there was somebody important there. There was something about me that liked that he thought that about me, that I was important and people knew me. And that's because we want people to be interested in us. We want attention. Now, for some people, that means, oh, I need to be the dominant person in the room and get all the attention. For other people, that's the opposite of it. That, like, they would hate that, but they want attention. I need two or three people who are just really so interested in me and really attentive to my needs. The key is, like, how would you feel when somebody else is getting that? Like, if you're the dominant person, how would you feel when somebody else is the dominant person in that room? Do you feel yourself, like, is that competition swelling up in you? That's the warning sign. Or if you're that person who doesn't like that, but you want that attention from one or two close people, what about when one of the two of those close people is, like, showing an interest in somebody else? Like, and jealous about that. Is that revealing, like, a thirst for attention in your life? What about the prominence? They wanted the sort of most important seats in the synagogues, the places of honour at the banquet. Is that something that we want that place of honour, we want that prominence, we want people to think we're important? I remember me and Lisa being invited for a meal once, and the person we invited is just sort of saying, oh, we invited you, it's really important to us, and we want to ask you, like, a couple of things, and just it felt good. It felt good that somebody was saying, oh, like, you're important to us. That's why we've invited you here. And there's nothing wrong with that. But then, do I then start to resent when I'm not the person? Oh, well, that person's had somebody else around me. Why wasn't I invited? Is that revealing a problem that I want to be the important one? There's a warning for all of us here that we shouldn't be motivated by trying to earn or to keep people's respect and the idea of honour. What about the thing of looking spiritual? So for a show, they're making lengthy prayers. I think all of us are guilty of doing or saying things in a church context to make ourselves look spiritually impressive, which is the equivalent of the leaders here praying lengthy prayers. It might mean that you're praying lengthy prayers to try and impress people. It might mean that you don't pray at all because you want people to think a certain way about you. You don't want to make a fool of yourself by opening your mouth. And so you're still making that decision based on what people think. It's easy in a Christian context. If you've been around Grace Church for a while, you can pick up or people say these sort of things. In a life group discussion, these are the sort of things that is worth saying. Or when it comes around to ask a prayer request, these are the sort of things people say. These are the sort of things we do. And it's easy to pick up the sort of, I don't know, cultural language and just sort of fit in with that to try and project a certain impression. These people that Jesus is criticizing were more bothered about what people thought than about people. Is that you? Let's be honest with ourselves. Do we find ourselves more bothered about what people think about me than I am about a person themselves? We're all in danger of these things. We need to listen to Jesus' warning to beware. We're all in danger of focusing on outward appearances, but God is looking at the heart. Now, I think the reason why we focus on trying to polish up the outside is because we're terrified of people seeing the heart. Jesus sees us as we are. He sees the darkness in our own heart, and he loves us. But Jesus was the opposite of these teachers of the law. Everything Jesus did was motivated out of love for other people. He wasn't motivated by what other people thought. Some things he did were popular, some things he did were unpopular. He was always motivated out of love for the person who he was dealing with. Now, Jesus was sometimes the guest of honour at the banquet. There's Simon the Pharisee who invites Jesus to a prominent banquet, and there's people around watching. And Jesus had been given the place of honour there. And then through a woman sort of coming and washing Jesus' feet, and Jesus then criticising his host, it ends up in a bit of like a sort of awkward, offensive sort of situation to the host. Jesus didn't use that place of honour to puff himself up. He used it to be gracious to outcasts, and it wasn't popular. But these teachers of the law loved to have the most important seats at the synagogue. Well, we read about Jesus in the synagogue towards the start of his ministry, and he's given the scroll to read, and he reads from Isaiah, and he says that it applies to him. He's chased out of the synagogue. He doesn't think, oh, I've got the prominent position in the synagogue here, let's get the attention onto me. He uses that place to speak truth. He gets chased out of the synagogue. They take him to a cliff and try and throw him off unsuccessfully. Jesus didn't devour widows' houses. He had compassion on widows. He didn't pray for show. He prayed because it was just part of his natural communication with the Father. We read over and over again that Jesus often withdrew to a quiet place to pray by himself. He does pray in public, but that was because it came out of a relationship with prayer that he had all the time. But Jesus didn't impress people with flowing robes, because in a couple of chapters' time, we're going to read that they took his robes off and cast lots for them while he was on the cross. We see in Jesus' popularity in this section, and it's about to nosedive so far that in a couple of chapters' time, the crowds are going to be chanting to crucify him. That's the opposite of impressive. Right? At this stage, Jesus, like, there was a bit of impressiveness around Jesus, but in a couple of chapters, there's not going to be. It's the opposite of impressive, but Jesus is not bothered about impressive, because he's acting from the heart. He's acting out of love for us. Jesus didn't use the word hypocrite here, but he's criticizing their hypocrisy. Everything they do is a mask. It's a show. It's an act. Jesus often calls the teachers of the law hypocrites. Now, if I say to somebody, oh, beware of that person, give them a wide berth, they're a hypocrite. Really, I mean, you should probably get to know that person and decide that for yourself and not just take my word for it. I might be wrong. But if God's calling somebody a hypocrite, then we need to listen. If we're honest with ourselves, we'll all recognize these same tendencies. But don't stop there when you recognize them. Don't stop by recognizing them and either leaving in despair, thinking, oh, that's me. Or leave just vowing to try harder to be stop being a hypocrite. What we need to do is to look at Jesus, the only non-hypocritical person who's ever lived. The only way to not be a hypocrite is to know the one who died for your hypocrisy. I just want to finish with a quote from a writer called Paul Tripp about this sort of thing. It says, God sees every thought of your heart. He sees every intention, every interaction. He sees every purpose and desire and motivation of your heart. There is not one movement of your heart that isn't fully known by the Lord. He's not fooled by your wealth. He's not fooled by your power. He's not fooled by your appearance. He's not even fooled by your theological ability. He's not fooled by your ministry. God is not fooled by your worship. God is not fooled by appearances, because God sees the heart. Now, how can you hear that and not live in utter terror? Because of Jesus. And in him, there is forgiveness. Forgiveness for every wrong thought. Forgiveness for every wrong motive. forgiveness for every wrong desire, and forgiveness for every selfish, ungodly intention. And his promise is this, that he will give us a new heart. God will settle for nothing less than owning your heart. But the same God who makes that requirement is the only hope for your heart, because in him there is forgiveness, in him there is life, in him there is hope. Let's pray.